KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Here's what's coming up next on Forum. First Bay Area author Joyce Maynard will discuss her new memoir, The Best of Us, in which she reflects on her marriage to Jim, whom she calls her first true partner. He died of pancreatic cancer just 3 years after the couple married, and as they struggled with his illness, Joyce Maynard says she discovered what love was as mine departed the world. Then at 10:30, we go live to a City Hall press conference on the passing of San Francisco Mayor Ed Lee. It's all coming up after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. When in her late 50s, journalist and novelist Joyce Maynard went looking for love online, she found Jim, a Bay Area lawyer whom she calls the first true partner she'd ever known. They got married, they bought a house together, planted olive trees, and went on long bike rides, and soon after, Jim was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. And less than 3 years after their wedding, actually it's less than 3 years after their relationship began, less than a year after their wedding, he passed away. And in her new book, The Best of Us, a memoir, Joyce Maynard says it was, quote, not until we learned of his illness and we walked the path of that terrible struggle together did I understand what it meant to be a couple. She's the author of 17 books, and she joins me in studio this segment to talk about her husband, her work, and the pain of final heartbreak. And welcome back to Forum, Joyce Maynard.
And the lessons, I would say, and the joy. I'll add those.
Okay.
Good morning, Michael. It's good to be here.
And good to have you. I want to find out from you, though. It's a moving book, and it's a book that certainly shares a good deal of personal pain and also joy, as you indicated, love late in life and then losing the beloved and the terrible tragedy of that. I'm wondering, because there is wisdom in this book as well. We just talked about the sad death of Mayor Lee earlier this morning. Anita Lee, Ed Lee's wife, is now going through the mourning process, as widows do. And what kind of wisdom would you impart to her, or for that matter, anybody who loses a loved one?
Well,
it's in your book,
I guess. And I would say that the experience that I had was the antithesis of what Mayor Lee's wife is going through now, because that's a different kind of grief. It's shocking and stunning and abrupt. I slowly watched the man that I love.
And their marriage was longer, and they had children
away.
And so
yeah.
forth. But just dealing with mourning, dealing with grief. Yeah.
For me, it was important to face it and explore it. And it's really how I've approached every experience in my life. I want to, feeling grief would not be my first choice, but I'd prefer it to feeling nothing. And I have allowed myself in the year and a half since Jim died, but really in the 3 years since we got this catastrophic diagnosis, to fully explore what it felt like. It's all life. It's all a part of life. And I think many of us are in a pretty major state of denial about the fact that death is an inevitable part of life. And if you live any length of time, you're going to lose people you love along the way. I would have given anything, just about anything, to have avoided this experience. But having had it, I'll be darned if I'm not going to take some wisdom from it.
You also had the experience of being the caretaker and dealing with what people deal with when there is a terminal disease of a loved one, having to find out whatever you could that would maybe be a reed of hope or some thought.
Part of this story, and I should say, I never think of The Best of Us as a cancer memoir. I prefer to think of it as a love story and an exploration on marriage, something that an experience I really did not understand until I was 60 years old. But the way that we approach this, and it's a very personal choice. There's no one right way to face a diagnosis like this one, was to fight like warriors. We did not take the Atul Gawande approach of sort of viewing death as a life experience and surrendering to it, which is a simplification, of course. We held on to every scrap of hope that there was, and I was a ferocious advocate. The same qualities in me that probably have rubbed many people the wrong way in previous times in my life were useful in this one. I was a dog going after a bone, you know.
Well, it comes across in your prose and in your narrative, and there are many other things that come across in addition to the devotion and the wonder that you found in this love relationship. I learned more than I ever would have imagined about fecal transplants, which is important, by the way.
It is. It is. And, I do not beat around the bush on this one. It's a procedure that, and somebody listening here someday is going to get C. diff, a very common ailment that is often contracted in hospitals, and people die from it. And Jim would have, if not for this, you know, procedure that makes some people very uncomfortable. It's exactly what you think it is, a fecal transplant. So I say those two words wherever I go, because they did. Ultimately, Jim died, but the fecal transplant saved his life from C. diff.
And died at home.
He died at home in our bed.
That means a lot too, doesn't it?
With, and I was beside him. I was beside him when he died. And I started to write this book that night, a fact which shocks some people, probably not people who are writers. It was the only thing I could do at that moment. Well, first I just lay there for about an hour because I knew I'd never be lying next to my husband again. But the next thing I did was to go downstairs and make a pot of coffee and open my laptop.
When I finished reading your book, I thought of a line from a poem, actually a fragment of a poem by Raymond Carver, who's mostly known for his short stories. You know what I'm speaking of?
I think I may have. It may be his very last poem. It's called Late Fragment.
Yes, and it's also on his gravesite.
It's on his gravesite, and it's actually the epigraph of my book.
Oh, that's right. It is the epigraph of your book.
I was beloved.
And it's also important to realize that he said, I found what I was looking for in life, and that is to feel beloved. But it's also being beloving as well.
Yes.
And that's what comes through in the book, is not only the feeling of being loved, but loving. And then suddenly Caitlin Flanagan comes out and calls you the queen of oversharing in The Atlantic.
Not the first time that I've been excoriated by a critic. But I'm older and wiser now, probably.
But this was a real... I mean, it was kind of a hit job in some ways.
Not in some ways. I think we can say in all ways safely, Michael. Yeah. I as I said, I'm no stranger to criticism. And certainly my earlier memoir, At Home in the World, was pretty universally condemned. In fact, I won't even say the book was condemned. I was personally
Well, you went through a few incarnations, if I could say, in terms of the criticism. One was for all the Salinger stuff. And then it was those daughters from Ethiopia that you adopted.
Well, and that was, of course,
And then gave back.
I'll talk about that, but there's no way to say that one simply or swiftly in a soundbite. So I'll take these one at a time and say that when At Home in the World was published, which is almost 20 years ago, the view, it's interesting in the current context of what's going on now in the Me Too movement, was that nobody questioned that a 53-year-old man who happened to be J.D. Salinger had written me letters and suggested I leave college and move in with him, but it was the view almost universally in the literary world was that I should have kept my mouth shut. I was called a predator, an exploiter. My favorite criticism was from the critic at Time magazine, who said, now that Joyce Maynard has told the only story she has of any value, meaning that I had briefly slept with a famous man, the one good thing about this book is we'll never have to hear from her again. And that was, I think, 9 books ago.
Actually, you're at 17, I think, now, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
But there was a lot of criticism because he was this icon of essentially reclusiveness and so forth. So you exposed him to the world in ways that perhaps should
I
not
told
have been
the story of what happened in my life. Right. Yeah.
And that's just what Caitlin Flanagan got on you for.
Well, and she, as you now allude to, the book is an exploration of marriage, of a late life marriage, and of the discovery, really, very late in the game, of what it meant to be part of a couple. I think I had a very naive and romantic view, unimaginative view, maybe, of what constituted romance. It was, you know, driving over the Golden Gate Bridge and having dinner in San Francisco and dancing under the stars and having oysters at Point Reyes and all sorts of things that I did experience in that brief, happy time with my handsome, debonair, smart, funny lawyer husband. But really, it was only when all of that was stripped away that I discovered all that mattered, which was what was left. But there is no
way.
It's
funny, all those ways you describe your husband, because she takes off on the fact that you described him as having a Porsche.
Too. Yes, a 1996 Porsche. But so what? If he'd had a new one, so what? He earned it. But there is no way to tell the story of a marriage embarked on by a 57-year-old and a 59-year-old without giving some context to who these people were and where they'd been before. You know, we had each of us a long history. We'd been on our own for 25 years, raised three children as single parents. And in my case, a part of the story that I couldn't not tell in this book was that not long before meeting Jim, I had experienced and been party to the worst and most devastating failure of my life at the age of 55.
As a single, two adoptions.
At the age of 55, as a single person, not with vast sums of wealth behind me, a writer, I made the decision to adopt two older children from Ethiopia. I did it with, you could call it extreme idealism or ignorance, but I believed that if there was one thing I knew how to do, it was love children and care for them and be a mother. I had done that three times and loved the job and missed it. And I recognized very early on, after bringing my girls home, that this was an uncharted territory. This was a completely different experience, and that I was not really the person they needed. Having said that and having realized that, I fully intended to stay the course, whatever cost to my own life. And it was pretty brutal. It was a very, very, these were girls who had experienced more pain and loss in their short lives than most of us have in our longer ones. But what I came to see, and as I said, there's no way to tell this story in a soundbite, after 14 months of trying very hard to be the mother they needed, was that I was not. Among other things, they needed a father.
Was not and could not be.
Could not be. Yeah. And I will say, I mean, the easy thing to say is they needed a father. They did. They needed other children in the family. They probably needed somebody younger. But they needed, I won't step away from the fact they needed somebody more solid, more grounded than I was able to be. I wanted love back. And they were not capable at that point of giving it. So I tell all this story as a prelude to the relationship with Jim, because the night I met him, I told him that story. You know, it wasn't your typical Match.com date, that's for sure.
I'm going to hand you something now in case you want to read an excerpt, which is from the prologue of your book.
But it was actually the afterword that I wanted to read, so I won't read this one. But
okay, but let me do this, because we only have a half hour with you, or up to the half hour mark, and I want to give listeners an opportunity to join us.
Wonderful. That's what I'd like best.
In fact, let me invite those of you who are listening to join us right now. The toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. If you have thoughts, if you have something you'd like to share or just join the conversation. Again, the number to call, 866-733-6786. I'll particularly invite those who have suffered a loss in a marriage, either widows or widowers. How do you cope with it? How do you deal with it? How do you get by day to day? I mean, we've had Joyce Carol Oates on talking about her book, about her memoir of being a widow. We had Joan Didion on talking about hers. And, you know, it's whether you lose a husband or you lose a wife, it's heartbreaking, and how you deal with it, I think, can be of use for people to hear if you have some thoughts.
While we're waiting for calls,
excuse me, Joyce. I want to give people an opportunity to communicate in a number of different ways because there's social media as well.
Okay, got it.
If they have questions or comments for you, they can join us by toll-free number, 866-733-6786. The time to call would be now, by the way, because we're only going up to the half hour. But you can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and clicking on this segment. Or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Sorry, Joyce.
And I have to say, my writer self feels a need to complete the story of the girls, that I What I did was to find them a family. I found them the family that they needed. I did not abandon them. I actually think I made the most loving choice I could for them, but a very
But in some ways, it almost came off to some of those other writers and some of those who were sniping at you as an abandonment.
Only one. I that was
Flanagan
enough.
Again?
That was enough. I don't think it's not my way as a writer to paint myself in a heroic light. I think part of my function is actually to explore my moments of
weakness,
failure, and flaws and vulnerability, because I call those moments of humanness. And they tend to be the ones that I think readers look for most.
Well, I mentioned Joyce Carol Oates. She describes you as unfathomably heroic. So, you know, you do have those who appreciate the work and the plummeting
well,
you
is
do
a,
into the self.
This is a book that also describes me, you know, shoplifting a hairbrush in the middle of our battle when I was just so angry at CVS waiting for, you know, the filling of a morphine prescription. And I don't think anybody's regarding me as a felon for or even a petty thief for doing that. I wanted to paint a real portrait of a real marriage under with of extraordinary tenderness and intimacy, and also its flaws.
I'm looking at a comment from a listener. Actually, it's a question from a listener. It says, I wonder if there were issues regarding his children's acceptance of the relationship. Well, there were.
There were.
Want to say anything about that? We got a lot of callers. We can go.
You know, I'll talk about anything that has to do with my life and my children.
That was Caitlin Flanagan's indictment.
Yeah. but I'm going to leave that one. I'll say that we were both one of the things that Jim and I shared at the moment that we met was that we had both been divorced parents for many, many years, and there are lots of ways that children can emerge from an experience of divorce, and mine adored Jim. And first for just how happy he made me, and then for who he was. And there was a time when I hoped the same would happen with his children, but it did not.
We're talking with Joyce Maynard. Her book is called The Best of Us, a memoir. And indeed, you both did find the best of you. Let me get a caller on here, and that's our first caller from Davis. Judith, good morning.
Hi, Judith.
Hi. This is going to be a challenge because I lost my legal domestic partner July 30th after he was diagnosed June 13th. So we had 6 weeks to prepare. Now, he was 79 and I am 77 now. Mm-hmm. And what I'm not hearing is the ordinary experience. I am a therapist. I have been a grief therapist, but I haven't been my grief therapist in this way. We had not quite 9 years together. We met hiking. Both of us had had other losses. And I find that I woke up the other morning after dreaming that I was calling him on the phone, but he couldn't answer.
Of course, yeah.
So I know how grief is physical and emotional, and that it takes whatever it takes, and nobody can tell you to get over it or move on.
And I'll never do that.
I'm so, first of all, Judith, sorry for you, really so sorry for your loss. I wonder if there's any advice you can give any, just dealing with grief. Like you say, you don't necessarily get over it, and this word closure never made sense to me personally with things of this sort, heartbreaks of this sort. Do you have any advice, any wisdom to share?
In me?
Yeah.
I am doing as much as I can to stay busy. I still am working as a therapist. I tend to garden. I exercise. I try and eat well. And I'm trying to start new starts. It's what I found and find very difficult is doing the things we did together by myself. Mm-hmm. I tried travel, and I found that I was too close to my grief to really interact in such a positive way. I lived in museums. I know that I'm doing the right thing. I'm using hospice as a help in their bereavement programs. And I'm being an ordinary person, going through my ordinary life,
embrace,
and trying to be there for other people.
Embrace that ordinariness, and I wish you good fortune, and I hope that you can find peace above all. Let me thank you for the call, and let me give you another caller on here, and that's Tom. Tom, you're on.
Good morning.
Oh, I'm sorry, this is Stephen. Stephen, go ahead.
Oh, hi, Michael, and hello, Joy.
Good morning.
Stephen, regular listener and infrequent caller, but Joyce, I've met you personally, and I'll just say that you encouraged me to put into writing my own tragedies in life, and that I didn't feel like I was oversharing when I was talking to you personally.
I remember you, Stephen. Good to hear from you. I would have added in the advice list. I don't know that I have followed the advice of keeping busy. I really wanted to dive directly into the wave of everything that was most painful. And I did it in the form. I happened to be lucky that I had the tools to write. But I'm a bit of a proselytizer about the value in telling one's story. I think I encouraged you to do the same, to write it down and not simply write down what happened, but there's a wonderful thing that happens when you first think about it a long time, that you discover you make meaning out of this sort of the chaos of undifferentiated grief. And I've seen it happen again and again. So I write memoir and I teach memoir. And I teach memoir not just to people who are going to publish books, but who have gone through a hard experience.
Let me thank Stephen for the call. We did this year, every year I emcee the National Kidney Foundation Luncheon, Literary Luncheon, which is a grand event. And you were one of the featured writers this year. And you had a whole collage, really, of scenes of you and your late husband doing all kinds of things and so forth.
I made a little video. It's actually, you can see it on my website. And it's after I made it, I kind of wondered, it's only 3 minutes long, but I almost felt, why did I write a 400-page book?
Well, that was my question. I mean, no, I don't mean that to be flip or anything, but
no.
When you write through and you do the cathartic narrative and so forth and try to reconstruct things, and there's a lot of detail, medical and so forth, as opposed to the joy that's in that collage.
Well, and I think there's joy in the book, too, and humor as well.
Let me get to the point of the question, which is when you re-experience things visually like that, it must be so countered and different from the writing process.
Yes, it is. I'm a storyteller, I told that story with pictures, but I love to tell stories with words. I want to say that although my book was cathartic, you shouldn't have to pay $20 for my catharsis. So I'd like to believe that it's perhaps cathartic for you reading it.
Well, here's Buster who tweets, I'll be picking up your book hopefully soon. We're slowly losing my 92-year-old grandfather to cancer. And today's news of Mayor Ed Lee's passing, devastating. Very sorry for your loss.
Thank you. Thank you.
We'll return. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're going to go live to a press conference shortly. We're going to have a few more moments with Joyce Maynard, author of The Best of Us, a memoir. She's a novelist as well as a memoirist. And here's Lubov, who writes, if you are not sure about the durability of your marriage, a serious illness of your spouse will make you walk away or turn you into a fierce advocate and protector. I didn't know how much I loved that man until he was diagnosed. We saw treatment and I lost him. He lived bravely for 7 years after a 2-year survival prognosis. And let me bring more of our callers in. Let's go next to Tom in Alameda. Good morning.
Well, hi, good morning. I wanted to elicit from your guest some kind of personal experience and advice on something I've been dealing with for the past year.
Yes.
A series of unfortunate premature deaths, some to addiction, suicide. And the hardest to take is an 8-year-old boy, my grandson, through family members' reckless driving. And through it all, a father who was convalescing in a nursing home who shows every sign in his late stage of the will to live, desire to live, yet diagnosed with the announcement from his provider that he has 3 months to live. The contradictions are kind of really difficult for me to render, and I was wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Well, good morning, Tom. And I have never experienced the loss of a child in close to me. So that's one beyond my imagination. But I will say that it, and this is probably flies in the face of what many people will, that I'm not a believer in trying to fill one's life with a lot of other things. I believe that it's important to honor the loss and to honor the feelings of sadness. I was telling Michael before the show began that I have fully immersed myself in the story of my husband and me for 3 years, basically. First the fight to save his life, and then the effort to tell this story, and then to bring it to you. And I now feel, having done that, that I can begin to move forward in my life. But if I had short-circuited that process, if I had attempted too soon to just pick up and carry on, I think I would be carrying it as an unhealed wound much more profoundly. And I know that because I've done that in the past with other losses. I didn't honor them.
But how prepared were you for this loss?
You know, officially I should have been, because the day we got that diagnosis, which is almost exactly 3 years ago, it was pretty much a terminal diagnosis, although we didn't accept it as such. We chose to fight very, very hard. But I don't think there's any preparing. I always believed there was going to be one more thing. I tell the story in the book near the end, after we've pursued so many things. We've traveled across the country to for Jim to have a 14-hour surgery to remove the tumor in his pancreas that still, you know, was going to give him maybe a 5% chance of survival. And the tumor came back. And at the end, when there was no longer any chemo, no longer any radiation, no longer any reishi mushrooms or turmeric drinks, I went on my Facebook page. I tried to think of what the most magical substance known to man or woman might be. And I came up with the breast milk of newly delivered women. This is an example, no question, of me at my, you know, I feel very ready to reveal to readers my odd self, my crazy self, because I think this kind of experience makes you crazy. So I put out the call for this colostrum with no illusion, really, that it was going to save Jim's life. I just wanted to give him something. And, you know,
you wanted to give him hope.
I wanted to give him hope, exactly. And three different women, Federal expressed me a tiny little vial of breast milk for him to put in the shot glass normally reserved for very good whiskey. And he downed it. And, you know, it was a happy day, or morning anyway. That little dream that maybe I had just found this magical cure.
It's that magical thinking, too, that goes with it, although you never had any illusions about it. But it's easy not only for the person who's suffering, but the person who wants.
And thank God we do have a little magical thinking, I would say, you know. Thank God we do. I researched medical teams all over, not just the country, but the world. And in fact, here we were in the San Francisco
Bay
Area.
It became a full-time job.
It did. It did. I had a phone on each ear so that if I was on hold with one person, I could talk to another. I was Federal expressing Jim's scans to all kinds of hospitals and teams. We traveled 3,000 miles to Boston for this surgery. We lived in the Bay Area, where there were two world-class medical facilities, UCSF and Stanford. And although I think we went to another world-class medical facility, it may well be that either of those others would have done no better or no worse, and the outcome would have been the same. But there was a belief in me that if we went further, tried even harder, that his odds might be better. And you know, I think that was a hopeful thing for him to feel, too, at the time.
Let me bring another caller.
He also got to go to Fenway Park as a result.
I remember. Joya, you're on the air. Good morning. Joya, are you there?
Hi, yes. I didn't hear you say my name. I am here.
Hi.
Right. my husband, Richard Kamler, was on your show, Michael. He's an artist. Do you remember him?
I do. Yes, indeed.
Yes. He died November 1st.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, the day before his 82nd birthday. He was... And
he's a lovely man. I remember him well.
Oh, God. We were together 46 years. So living without him, you know, it's like... I can't even tell you how painful it is. You get so intertwined in that much time. He's my best friend, my closest kin. The whole identity of being in a couple for that long, you know, two artists and being, it's with the same values and so much experience together. Our son, our two grandsons. Oh, I heard that man lost his grandson. God, how horrible. What I've been doing, one of the things I'm doing, I don't know if it's helping. I'm miserable all the time, but I've been writing to Richard. I've been keeping a journal for years, so now I write to him. I write him letters every day. Mm-hmm. You know, basically I'm sort of pleading with him to come back, but other things, I tell him about my life. And
but it helps, you're saying, I think, aren't you?
Yeah, and I talk to him out loud. I mean, I'm in the house that we lived in for many years together, and he's here everywhere, you know. I go in the kitchen, he's there when I'm fixing food. I see him, you know, cutting the garlic as he's helping me fix this. I see him everywhere, but, you know, I don't feel him. I just imagine him. And so I talk to him out loud, too. And I think that helps. It usually starts me crying, but, you know, crying is wonderful. I mean, I do a whole lot of it, keening, moaning, crying, and I highly recommend it. But I also want to say a friend of mine who's a psychologist said, and this is in reference to being in the pain of the grief, she said there's studies that show that people who distract themselves, not all the time, but, you know, a reasonable amount of time, they recover sooner. And I'm finding that if I go out with friends, I'm not working now, I normally teach, I'm going back in January, but... just doing things. I went to the museum the other day. I go for walks, and being with other people is, I feel like if I don't do that, I will go out of my mind.
Stay sane, stay strong, and again, Joya, thank you for calling. I'm so sorry for your loss. Any thoughts from you, Joyce Maynard?
Well, I think everybody's way of grieving is particular to them. And for me, you know, I was in the rare situation of being a writer. And I had a very specific tool. Sounds like Joya is an artist, and I would be surprised if she hasn't been painting it in some way. But what I knew to do was to tell my story. And because readers have been such an important part of my life.
Do you talk to Jim the way she talks?
I do, yeah, for sure. I mean, usually in the car.
Yeah.
He didn't know who got elected president a year ago. And I have said, you know, if pancreatic cancer hadn't killed him, that man who shall be nameless would have.
But you keep the spirit alive in a strange way, I suppose.
Well, I think it has to do with sharing the story. You know, if it's just keeping his spirit alone, a tribute to Jim, then you don't necessarily need that. That's my private altar to him. But I actually derive enormous, I won't just say comfort, but actual joy from hearing from readers, not just people like Joya and Tom and Stephen, who've had losses of their own, but people who haven't, who are inspired by our story. I say at one point in the book, if only you could have the lessons of cancer without cancer. And in many ways, that's what I hope to do in these pages.
Well, thank you for the work you've done. We are going to take another call or two. Until I just want to remind listeners that we're waiting for the conference on the passing of Mayor Ed Lee to start. And we're talking to Joyce Maynard, who's the author of The Best of Us, a memoir. And here's Eric from Sausalito. Eric, join us.
Yeah, hello.
Good morning.
I have an interesting story of loss, and I didn't lose the love of my life to death, but I lost her to mental illness. So she can't understand who I am. She hears voices of people who aren't there and then has vilified me as being in cahoots with them.
Uh-huh.
So I'm still so in love with her. We're together for 10 years, and she doesn't recognize me. So I don't know how to deal with the loss, and it's been, you know, really happened over the last 6 months or so.
Harry, this is so painful to hear. I'm sorry for what you're going through. Have any thoughts, Joyce Maynard?
Well, you know, I first of all, I just want to acknowledge and honor your pain, Eric, and then say, if this is helpful at all, and I think maybe it can be, that I know you're not alone. I suspect your grief is such a strangely, you know, it's a death that's not a death. You're not the first person I have spoken with who has told this story, and you might not have ever met another one who has, which is one of the functions, I think, of memoir. Of, you know, we it makes us feel less alone. The woman that you loved is not the woman who is vilifying you now. She's that woman is gone, but you never got to bury her or mourn her, and I can't speak from personal experience except to say that I recognize your pain. And I hope there's some comfort in just knowing that.
And there are some books, Eric, that I come to mind fleetingly that really deal with the kind of problem that you're facing. And reading other people's memoirs of this sort can really be quite helpful. I would encourage that. And writing, of course, as we've been talking about this whole time with Joyce Maynard. And thank you for the call. I wish you the best. We are now going live to City Hall. I want to thank Joyce Maynard. And again, her book is The Best of Us, a memoir.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.